If you have a Bible with you, you may want to turn to the 37th chapter of the book of Genesis, Genesis 37. While you're doing that, pardon me, it was my breakfast. While you're doing that, I need to make a confession. I have sinned. I am guilty of the sin of envy. I want to be Ronnie Norman. That's just all there is to it. I really, really do. Ronnie and Martha are two of the most special people on this planet. I do hope you know that. Sometimes when a minister has been with the church as long as he's been here, you begin taking for granted that level of talent and giftedness. I hope you don't. Because I travel all across America, around the world. I get to hear all kinds of preachers, meet all kinds of people. You have one of the top, period, anywhere. You need to know that. I'm not sure when I'll get past the sin of envy. I think it'll stay for a while. In Genesis chapter 37, there's a story about a guy named Joseph. You've heard it. As a matter of fact, there's several Bible stories that go with this. And when I talk about dreams, understand that I'm not talking about wishes. Because wishes can vary. You know, one day you wish for this, the other day you wish for that. They just change all around. Dreams, in the sense of what we'll talk about today, do not. They focus. Wishes can fade. I wanted this, but now it's changed, and I don't want that anymore. And dreams never fade. They drive you for the rest of your life. Now, those are the kind of dreams I'm talking about. In the story, as you have read it before, therefore I'm not going to read all of it, just a couple of verses in a minute. What happens is that Joseph is one of the younger sons. Actually, he's the next to the youngest when they all get done. And his brothers don't like him because he made a mistake. The mistake he made was that God had given him a dream, and the mistake was telling that dream to his brothers. Basically, in the dream, it indicated that they someday would bow down to him, and brothers didn't like that. Have you ever had any sibling rivalry in your household? My older brother is 6 years older than I. Remember, he was 14. He got appendicitis. They misdiagnosed it, and he almost died. And he was in the hospital for several days like they used to do back then. And that made me 8. He was 14. He came home, and he was hobbling around like he was 99 years old. It was just kind of sickening to watch. And so as he hobbled around as like this old man, they told him he had to exercise. We lived on a dirt road. He walked about a tenth of a mile up that road, turned and started back. It had taken him a while. Now, all the guys will understand this, and there's no way to explain it to the women. Okay? An 8-year-old, you understand this, guys. I looked at him and thought, wonder can I chunk a rock that far? So I found a nice flat one that would just really sail when I threw it. It was an outstanding shot. Hit him on the scar. Oh, it was therapeutic. He had you know, hobbled up that road. He ran back down it. And in my whole life, that's still the hardest I've ever been hit. Ever. Ever. And so brothers can be like that sometimes, but this gets even worse because then he has another dream that not just that his brothers are going to bow down to him someday, but he dreams that his father and mother will bow down to him someday, and his dad doesn't like that either. You mean someday you think you'll rule us? But yet the father was wise enough to put in his head like, maybe this is something. Maybe this came from God. The brothers are all tending sheep. Joseph goes after them. He's 17 years old. And as he goes after these guys, here's what it says in Genesis 37, beginning in verse... Well, I don't have my glasses. I have no clue what verse that is. It's either an ant or it's verse 19. I'm not sure which. And here's what they said. They said, here comes that dreamer. And yet when they say it, they're not saying it as a compliment because the next thing they said was, let's kill him. Now, you need to understand, if God ever gives you a dream, not a wish, not a fantasy, not something that you might want to do someday, but if God ever calls you to a dream, whatever that dream is, people will want you dead. And sometimes the people that will want you dead will be the very people that you think should be on your side, your own brothers or sisters. My mentor, Paul Torrance, told it to me this way. He said, Joe, when you lead, not only do you get shot at by the enemy, but by all those people on your side who aim too low. And often what happens is because people do not have a dream, or God gave them a dream but they didn't have the courage to follow it, they don't want you to fulfill the dream you were called to either because they can't handle it. Joseph was then sold by his brothers into slavery. They didn't kill him because of Reuben's influence. He sold into slavery. You remember the story. Winds up in Potiphar's house, which becomes extremely important, by the way. He takes care of things at Potiphar's house for a while. Then Mrs. Potiphar goes for him, makes a move on him. He resists her. As a matter of fact, he actually ran out of his clothes. She grabbed it, and his coat came off as he ran away because he wasn't about to be involved with her. Potiphar, in his pride, didn't put him in the regular prison. Potiphar put him in Pharaoh's prison. You may remember from this particular Pharaoh, he was rather capricious. He would put people in prison, take people out of prison. Remember that butler and baker story from the Old Testament? And you look at all this and you go, why? If God gave him that dream, what's going on? Well, actually, if you remember, the dream is there's going to be 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. And in the 7 years of plenty, Egypt needs to store a lot of grain. Joseph knows nothing about grain. He's a sheep herder, and it's not in the job description. Yet if you read about what happens when he was in Potiphar's house, it said he takes care, or he took care of Potiphar's house and fields. What he learns as a slave is that he learns farming. He learns how to grow this grain, how to take care of this grain. And now he's going to have to learn something else, and that's going to be politics. He's going to have to learn how to work with Pharaoh. And the best place to learn politics is in prison. So God let him go to prison. They all wind up there. He started there. He goes to prison. And in that prison, he actually wound up running the prison as a trustee, we'd call it today. And so he's meeting these people that Pharaoh's throwing in a prison and taking out of prison, putting back in prison, taking out of prison. And so he's learning all about Pharaoh before he ever meets him, his weaknesses, his strengths, his idiosyncrasies, so that the day he is called to interpret a dream for Pharaoh, he has no learning curve left. He knows grain farming. He knows how to work with Pharaoh. It took 13 years to prepare him for this. Now, I don't know how you were when you were 17, or I don't know how you are if you are 17, but I remember when I was 17. Seems like it was last week, but when I was 17, if God had come to me and said, Joe, yes, sir, got a mission for you, what would that be? I'm going to make you the second most powerful man on the planet, and you're going to save my people. At 17, I would have said, cool, I can do that. How many of you at 17 would have thought, I can do that? I saw a bumper sticker when they said, hire a teenager quick while they still know everything. So here I was. If God had made such an offer to me, I would have taken it. But if I'd have had any sense, and this particular Joseph probably would have done the same thing if he said, Joseph, I'm calling you. Okay, here's what I want you to do. Second most powerful man, save my people. Okay, if he'd had any sense, he would have said, and what's the job? Can you just give me the job description? What are the qualifications? Well, first you've got to learn grain farming. I don't know anything about it. I know, so I'm going to put you into slavery. That's not a metaphor, is it? I mean, you're really going to make me a slave, right? Yes, people can own you, buy you, sell you, do anything they want to do with you. And then you're going to have to work with Pharaoh, so I'm going to put you in prison when you don't deserve to go to prison. The Bible actually says that Joseph was well-built and handsome, which is true of everybody named Joseph. Just some of us are built differently. And he would have said, I'm too pretty to go to prison. And then he would have asked the question, Lord, how long would this take? And if God had said 13 years, how long is 13 years to a 17-year-old? A lifetime. And so Joseph may have said, I appreciate the opportunity, but would you take Issachar, Judah, Reuben, anybody but me? I'm too pretty to go to jail. So God didn't ask. Now, why in the world do you think Joseph stayed faithful? You know that he didn't like being a slave. By the way, we also know that he thought his father didn't care about him. His father was rich. His father could have mounted an army and come after him. Joseph doesn't know that the brothers have deceived the father into thinking he's dead. All Joseph knows is that daddy doesn't come. Later, when he finally gets out of prison and marries, he names his first son a name that means forgotten. He felt forgotten. You can't blame him. And if you'd have talked to him when he was a slave and said, son, what's your future? What's it going to be like 10 years from now? He said, I'm not sure the timeline, but someday I'm going to be a ruler and people will bow to me. Boy, you're insane. You're a slave. Slaves don't become rulers. This one will. How do you know? God gave me a dream. Dream on, boy. Dream on. And when he was in the dungeon, if they'd walked up and said, now, what do you think your future's going to be? I'm going to be a ruler someday. You're in prison, son. You're in a dungeon where you may die. How in the world could you possibly think that someday you could be a ruler? Because God gave me a dream. You see, I'm convinced that the reason that Joseph would not have sin with Mrs. Potiphar is not because of the fact that he was so morally stout, but because of the fact that he had a dream that was overriding everything else. God has a purpose for me. There's something God wants me to do. And if I do this, I'm detouring off that dream, off that path that God has for me. Why did he stay faithful in prison, even when he felt forgotten? It's because God has something for me to do. I think that perhaps it's easier to do the right thing when you know that God is sending you a particular direction than if you're just trying to be good. Does that make any sense at all? You say, well, does God call dreamers today? I'm quite sure he does. Now, if you understand and start looking at this, we give all kinds of excuses why dreams won't work. I mean, Joseph could have. I'm a slave. I'm a prisoner. It can't happen. Well, let's see. Let's go pick a couple of Bible stories. If you say, well, it's a man's world. I'm a female. We don't have the same opportunities as men. I would agree that you're probably right. I think there is still prejudice toward women. I really do. They're not treated equally in everything. So therefore, you're talking about dreams that God gives men, not dreams that God gives women. Well, in the fourth chapter of the book of Judges, there's a woman whose name is Deborah. She has become the judge of Israel, which is really interesting because it was definitely a male society. And she was ruling. And they had this king of Canaan called Jabin that had conquered them and had been overruling them for 20 years. And he had 900 chariots of iron. That's equivalent to 900 tanks in his army, okay? And so God called Deborah and said, we're going to take these guys down. And so she calls her general Barak, and she says, we're going to take these guys down. And Barak says, I ain't going unless you go. Proving he was a man's man. And she said, okay, I'll go with you, but because of the way you're going about this, God is going to give the honor to a woman. The battle that day went well for the Israelis. Finally, Sisera, the other general, is running away. He's exhausted. He's tired. He goes by a tent of some people he happens to know. The woman who is there is named Jael. She comes out and she sees him, and he's extremely tired. And she said, come in, my lord. Come in. He came into her tent. He asked for water. She gave him milk. He said, would you just watch and make sure that nobody comes in while I sleep a little? I'm so exhausted. And he laid down. And when he fell asleep, she took a tent stake and a mallet, and she put it on his temple and drove it completely through his head. And I love what the Bible says there. It says, and he died. You say, well, I'm too young. Oh, I love the story of David and Goliath, don't you? And Goliath's fascinating. He was 9.5 feet tall, a big man. The biggest man I ever saw in person was Andre the Giant. Anybody remember Princess Bride, that movie? The man was 7.5 feet tall, and he was that big. I saw him in the Atlanta airport many years ago, the old Atlanta airport. Jurassic Park hadn't come out yet, so I didn't know what it meant when the floor went boom, boom, boom. I had to look up, and here's a mountain of a man, gigantic. His fists were big as hams. I thought, if I had him in my freezer, I could eat for a year. He came on down, and then I realized he was going to get on our plane, and I thought, we're not ever leaving the ground. Goliath, he was 7.5 feet tall. Goliath was 9.5 feet tall. What makes that more interesting is the anthropologists say that the average Jewish male of the day was 5'3". Isn't that fascinating? The average Jew is 5'3". He's 9'6". He's two Jews high. It says that the breastplate he wore weighed 125 pounds, so he's wearing a Jew here as well. The head of his spear weighed 25 pounds. Remember how that the people would line up and they were going to go into battle? Obviously, you look for the biggest guy on your side. So you look around, and that's King Saul, who's a head and shoulder taller than the average Jewish male, the Bible says. So let's say he's 6'3". You look at him and say, there's our king. There's our giant. He'll go fight that other giant. But Saul was in his tent planning, because he was afraid, apparently. And a 15-year-old boy comes along. I'll kill that giant. The first people that turned against him, guess who? His brothers. See anything familiar here? They made fun of him. You're just a sheep herder out in the desert. He finally gets to see King Saul, and Saul says, why do you think you can do this? He said, well, once a lion came after my sheep, and I picked up a stick, and I killed him. On another occasion, a bear came after my sheep. I picked up a stick, and I killed him. And you're thinking, this is a tough 15-year-old kid here. If he's got a stick, don't get around him. And so Saul says, okay, you can go fight him, but you have to wear my armor. Now, if he's 15 years old, the average male is 5'3". Let's say he's probably under 5 feet. Saul's maybe 6'3". There's no way Saul's armor is going to fit him. You understand? But it's typical. We say to the ones that will do what we won't do, okay, but you have to do it our way. David said, I'm not going to do it your way. As a matter of fact, if I were David, I'd have been very unimpressed with Saul's way. He said, I just need some rocks. I love those Bible classes where people ask you questions the Bible doesn't answer. You know, there's no way you can know the answer. I love those questions because I make up the answers. They asked me one Bible class, why did he pick up 5 rocks? I said, Goliath had 4 brothers. So he goes down. Well, he did, but they weren't there. He goes down, and when the giant sees him and starts toward him, the giant is extremely upset. Remember the story, how upset he was? Am I a dog that you send a boy to fight me? And he told David he was going to kill him. And this 15-year-old boy says, mm-mm, you've done it now. I'm going to have to cut your head off. And they start into the battle, and David makes and what I estimate to be one of the best sermons ever preached. And he talks about how that God doesn't win with the sword or the spear or the shield, that God by his power does what he does. And then he says, I'll have to kill you so that all those gathered here, and I don't see him pointing over there on the other side. I see him pointing at the guys on his side hiding behind him. He said, so all those gathered here will know there is a God in Israel. Why would a boy do that? He had a dream. He knew that God had called him to a particular service, and that service he was going to do. It's impossible. You cannot win. If God sends me to the battle, I go. Don't you have any sense? I have a dream. I do what God tells me to do. You say, well, but look around our culture. Anybody ever just, if you want to be in a bad mood, you just turn on the news? It's just you watch the news, and it's just bad news. I mean, one bad thing after another, after another, after another, and you go, man, can the world get any worse? And it does. And every time you say it can't get any worse, it does even that. You can even fly on an airplane now 150 miles past where you're going. It's all fascinating as to what's going on in this world. And you say, so we're just outnumbered. We who are Christians are outnumbered. Well, actually, we are becoming outnumbered. There's no doubt about that. Quick story about that. Remember Gideon? The angel of Jehovah came to Gideon and called him into battle with the Midianites because the Midianites had conquered Israel. They were starving the people. They were burning their crops. He was threshing his wheat in a wine press. What that means was he was hiding out, threshing the wheat in a place they wouldn't look for him. And this angel of Jehovah says, I want you to go fight these people. There's 135,000 men in the Midianite army, trained, equipped, battle-hardened soldiers. Gideon says, I got to have a better sign. He puts out a fleece. You remember the fleece story? One day it's dry, one day it's wet. He did it twice. I hear people all the time saying, let's put out a fleece. And I'm going, have you not read that story? God didn't get happy about that fleece. Because you see, it just showed, it showed Gideon's doubt. So that finally Gideon raises an army of 32,000 men. So the odds now are a little over 4-1. I'd still, if I were a betting man, bet on the Midianites. What about you? Odds 4-1, trained soldiers against farmers. And God said, you got too many. Tell anybody that wants to go home, they can. He said, if you want to go home, you can. 22,000 said, that's all we needed to hear. And they went back to the house. 10,000 men left. God said, you got too many. He thinned it down to 300 men. And you know that Gideon's got a saying, may I speak to the angel in charge of accounting? Because now the odds are 450-1. 450-1. Why? Because he doubted. He had to put a fleece out. So people say, Joe, let's put a fleece out. Let's just do what he says. It'll be a whole lot easier if we don't go through this doubt process first. But we can't win. No, we can't. But it's not by the sword or the shield or the spear that God wins. People on my own side will turn against me. That's correct. I'll be castigated and vilified. Yes, you will. People won't understand me. Yeah, you got that right. It'll be miserable. Now you're catching on. So why should I do it? Because it changes the world. He saved the people of Israel from starvation. Let me just move very quickly to a modern-day illustration. I grew up in the Deep South. I was born in 1949. I'll save you the trouble, I'm 60. I was born in 1949. And in the 50s, if anybody remembers the 50s, it was a great time in some sense of the word. You didn't lock your doors at night. You just hit the screen so it wouldn't blow open in the wind. And if you got in trouble three blocks away, that mama spanked you. And by the time you got home, it had gone through the mama network, and then your mama spanked you. And it was just a simple world to live in, but it was also an extremely and highly prejudiced world. You see, people of color, if their skin was black, they could cook my food, but they couldn't sit at the table with me to eat it. And we had three restrooms at the service stations. There was the men's and the women's and the coloreds. And they didn't clean the coloreds. I'm not making this up. Anybody lived through that? It was a terrible time. You say, well, surely you weren't that way. Sure I was. That's what I was trained to be. I was prejudiced because that's what I was trained to be. It was later when I began to understand differently. Even then, in my heart, I knew something wasn't right, you know? But it's the culture I was born into. There was a man by the name of Martin Luther King Jr. who changed me. Not just me, but America. Interestingly, not just America, but the world. Interestingly also, he's not a very tall guy. I've seen his suit in the international terminal at the Atlanta airport. He couldn't have been over this tall. He just wasn't a big man physically. 1954. I'm 5 years old when this starts. Rosa Parks refuses to give up her seat on a bus to a white man, which is the law in Montgomery, Alabama. If you are colored, which is the word they used, if you are black, you have to give up your seat to a white if he wants it. And she refused. They arrested her. Thus started the great boycott of Montgomery, Alabama bus system, which was costing the city a lot of money. Reverend Ralph Abernathy, who was a minister there in Montgomery at the time, called a big rally, and people came from all around to his church. There were so many they couldn't get inside. They opened the windows, and they had more outside than they had inside, trying to, and one black minister after another would stand up and address these people. A new minister just moved to town. His name was Martin Luther King Jr. He had just finished his doctorate. He would never speak extemporaneously. He always would speak from a manuscript he had written out by hand. He comes in late, expecting to be the young preacher totally ignored. Reverend Abernathy sees him and says, "And now we will hear from Dr. King, who has no written out prepared speech." He's kind of panicky. He walks up, he opens his mouth, he starts talking, and when he finishes, he is the de facto leader of the civil rights movement in America. You have to wonder where a speech like that came from, don't you? Have you looked at the newsreels? Have you seen what happened back in those days in Birmingham, Memphis, Selma? One of my friends now, wasn't my friend then, because I lived in a different world. One of my friends then was on that bridge in Selma with Dr. King. If you've ever seen those films from that bridge, Governor Wallace had ordered the state troopers to go stop them. They were going to march from Selma to Montgomery, and as they came across that bridge, those state troopers were there with batons, big wooden sticks, and dogs, and gas. And so I asked my friend who was on that bridge, "I've seen those films. I've seen those dogs tear into people's flesh. How could you do that and not fight back?" He said, "Oh, Joe, if you could have hurt him, you would follow that man into hell and fight Satan himself." Was it easy for Dr. King? Let me play a quick clip. Let's play that first clip of Dr. King just for a minute, if you don't mind.
"The telephone started ringing and I picked it up. On the other end was an ugly voice. That voice said to me in substance, 'Nigger, we're tired of you and your mess now. And if you aren't out of this town in 3 days, we're going to blow your brains out and blow up your house.' And then I got up and went back to the kitchen and I started warming some coffee, thinking the coffee would give me a little relief. I sat there and thought about a beautiful little daughter who had just been born about a month earlier. She was the darling of my life. I'd come in night after night and see that little gentle smile. And I sat at that table thinking about that little girl and thinking about the fact that she could be taken away from any minute. And I got to the point that I couldn't take it any longer. I was weak. Something said to me, you got to call on that something and that person that your daddy used to tell you about. That power that can make a way out of no way. I discovered then that religion had to become real to me, and I had to know God for myself. And I bowed down over that cup of coffee. I never will forget it. Oh, yes, I prayed a prayer. I say, Lord, I'm down here trying to do what's right. I think I'm right. I think the cause that we represent is right. But, Lord, I must confess that I'm weak now. I'm faltering. I'm losing my courage. Seemed at that moment that I could hear an inner voice saying to me, Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. Stand up for truth. And lo, I will be with you even until the end of the world.
An amazing man. Was he perfect? Absolutely not. Did he have flaws? Just like all the rest of us. Like Joseph was flawed. Like Deborah was flawed, like Barak was flawed, like Gideon was flawed, like David was flawed. I'm flawed. You're flawed. We're all flawed. If God had to have a perfect person for a mission, he could only do it once. He did that with a perfect person. Everything else has to be done through people who are imperfect. But that man, as you heard, believed in the Lord God Almighty. Was he afraid? You heard him say he was. Was he weak? I mean, if somebody threatened the lives of my children, I don't know if I could go on. Could you? Racial prejudice has not been done away with. But if you had lived in the 60 years I have lived, you would know it is far better now than it was then. It's not right yet, but it's far better now than it was then because of that man following a dream. He actually called it a dream. The key part of it is that someday people would not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. How did it turn out for him? April 1968, went to Memphis to support a garbage man strike. A very short clip. Let's just listen for a second.
I got into Memphis, and some began to talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live,
Lorraine Motel. He'd come out on the balcony, talking to his friends in the parking lot about where they were going for dinner. The shot came from over there, and the man was dead. He understood that dreams, if they're worth living for, are worth dying for. And what I look for, and I hope that I see, are more dreamers. I remember about a quarter of a century ago when this church started from a dream with basically a handful of people. And now Ronnie's up here talking about the stuff you're doing all over the world. It was a dream. I'm sure it hasn't been easy. I'm sure there have been difficulties across the line. I'm sure there have been times when, and some of you at least, have felt weak or troubled or turned against or shot at by your own brothers, and you just wanted to give it up. But the blessing to you was that you had been given a dreamer, Ronnie Norman. But now we need more dreamers. God, please give us a David. Give us a Deborah. Give us people with the faith to do what must be done, and that no matter how bad it gets, no matter how painful, even if they realize they may be shot to death, they will not stop their dream. If your dream is from you, pray that God will stop you. If your dream is from God, pray that He won't let you stop. We've got to make a difference. We have to keep changing the world in spite of our flaws. There are so many things that need to be done. How many dreamers has God called who never had the courage to follow the dream? What about you? Father, we thank you for everything that you have done for us. I personally thank you for this great church. I thank you for Ronnie and Martha, and I thank you for the leaders of this church and the staff of this church and the fine people in this church. And God, the blessings that you have brought not only to this church but to this community through you and places like Four Corners and the missionaries they support around the world and all the good things that happen. God, continue to give them courage forever, as long as they shall live, come life or death. And oh God, if there's somebody in this audience today you're calling to be a dreamer, give him or her, whether young or old, black or white, makes no difference, whoever you call, give them the courage to obey and courage for a lifetime. Use us, Lord, to change the world.